The framers knew too well the dangers of a king who could do no wrong. They therefore devised a system to check abuses of power, especially the use of official power for private gain.
Justice Department lawyer Michael Dreeben at the Supreme Court today, he was laying out the government's case for why former President Donald Trump does not have total immunity from prosecution for trying to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Trump is facing four counts in this federal case, including conspiracy to defraud the United States and obstruction of official proceedings. Trump's lawyers claim he cannot be tried because he was still the president when all this was taking place after the November 2020 election, and therefore he has immunity from prosecution. Lower courts have rejected that argument. Trump is, of course, the first former president who has faced criminal prosecution. So the nine justices grappled with the concept of immunity, not just for him, but for future presidents. Jessica Levinson is here now, Loyola Law School professor and our regular Legal Eagle. Hello.
Hello.
Well, the question the court had laid out for itself is this, and I'm going to quote, whether and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office? So translate that for us, because it seems that they put in official acts for a reason.
They certainly did. And this discussion of what exactly is an official act played a really big role in the 2.5 hour play that we saw this morning. And so what the question presented was really, let's imagine that you're president and that you engage in acts that are clearly not private acts. They're clearly not, for instance, golfing, which would be a private act. Acts that are arguably official, talking to the Department of Justice about whether or not there was fraud in an election, for instance. Do you have any sort of immunity from criminal prosecution? And the question is, if you do, how much? And that was really what the justices struggled with, again, over almost 3 hours, which is, let's imagine that you do engage in these official acts. How can we, if we think you violated a criminal law, how can we hold you accountable? And can we?
Right.
We can get into all the details, but that's the plain English version of the question.
Right. So there would be a higher bar for public acts, presumably, than for private acts when it comes to holding a president responsible.
Well, maybe not just a higher bar. So one of the possibilities here is that if the thing that you did, the thing that's alleged in the criminal complaint, is considered to be an official act, then it is just off limits, period. You are immune from criminal prosecution. And what the justices, I think, were trying to struggle with is that really the rule that we're going to lay out here? Is it just we consider it official and that's it? Or is there a bit more nuance? And I think the answer is, I thought I counted five justices for it's a bit more nuanced than just it's official and we're done.
Right, because Trump's team was saying, look, his actions after the election were not at all for private gain, so therefore cannot be construed as private acts at all. The Trump was just trying to expose election fraud. That's what they say, which is in the public interest. What did the justices say to that?
Well, actually, one of the things that was really interesting that happened pretty early on in the oral arguments is that the justices did get Trump's attorney to admit that not all of the actions here could be considered official acts. And that was really a line that ran through the arguments, that there was an understanding, and again, I read it as a clear admission from Trump's lawyers, that there were things that were alleged here that you couldn't say fall within even the outer ambit of what official acts are. Things like talking to a private attorney or a private advisor about how to try and stay in power, potentially illegally staying in power. And so there was some acknowledgement that you can move forward on some of the claims. And again, we're talking about the federal case pending against the former president in DC dealing with election interference. But then the next layer down is, if you can proceed on these private acts, can you bring in evidence of official acts, even if you can't have liability for an official act?
Hmm.
It starts to get really complicated.
Yeah, it gets a little complicated. So this idea is of wanting to stay in office, of fighting for re-election. Is that what they debated over, whether that's an official act or not? Because is it in the public interest for a president to fight for his re-election, or is it in his private interest?
Well, I think what they did is actually something slightly narrower, which is they kind of acknowledged, okay, let's say all of these acts are about Trump trying to stay in power. And there was some discussion of, does it matter what his motive is? Does it matter if his motive is just for private gain? Mm-hmm. But what they were really saying is some of these acts to try and stay in power, they look fairly official. Again, talking to members of the Department of Justice, for instance. But then some of these acts look pretty private, pretty personal. Again, like talking to a private attorney. And so what they really were trying to do is sift out, how do we put these two buckets together? On the one hand, the acts where we think that, again, it's not just Trump, it's any future president, as you said when we started this discussion. How do we fill out that bucket of when you're immune? And then how do we put enough in the bucket of, there are some things where clearly you have to be subject to criminal prosecution, and those are the private acts.
All right. So they all seem to believe in some form of immunity, or at least some non-form of immunity,
yes,
but to different extents. And so I want to play a tape from Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, who brought up the dangers of too much presidential immunity.
The concern about having a president unbounded while in office, a president who knows that he does not have to ultimately follow the law, because there is really nothing more than, say, political accountability in terms of impeachment.
Okay, so what did other more conservative justices say to that? Because that has been the so far successful prosecutorial argument, at least in the lower courts, that no president is above the law. So what did the conservative justices say about that idea?
You know, it's really interesting, because this is where I read the biggest divide in terms of what are the consequences that you're most worried about. And when it came to the liberal justices, and we just played that tape from Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, her fear on consequences was, what happens if we say a president is above the law? What happens if we say there are no repercussions for certain types of actions? What type of society are we really living in that case? Let's remember, the president's duty is to take care to faithfully execute the laws. That's in the Constitution. That's its main function. And then you heard the conservative justices, I think, very worried about, what happens if we subject this president to criminal prosecution? Will this then become a pattern? And so each president says, when it comes to their predecessor or to a future political opponent, let's go get them. Let's try and, you know, find a way to bring up criminal charges. And that was the consequence that they were more worried about. But that's where I frankly heard, as I said, the greatest division along the typical lines that you and I talk about, that, you know, who's the conservative and who's the liberal and how is this going to turn out?
Okay, so what do you expect will happen? You expect them to send this back to the lower court with some amendments?
Yes, so I think it's going to take them some time. I mean, this conversation, we got into the weeds. It's complicated. It's going to take them some time to figure out, when does a president have immunity from criminal prosecution and when does he not? I expect that's not going to happen until the end of June at the earliest, frankly. And then I think the rule that they lay out, the standard, could go back to the trial court judge, back to Judge Chutkan to apply. If Trump doesn't like the way she applied it, that then goes back to the D.C. Court of Appeals. I'm explaining all this because your listeners know exactly what I'm about to say, which is, whatever happens politically, it's a win for the former president, because this is a delay and it's going to be a significant delay.
Right. So it might be delayed until after the election. And if he wins the election, he could, as expected, dismiss the entire case. Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Come Coming up, why Harvey Weinstein's rape conviction was thrown out in New York and what that could mean for his California rape conviction. That's coming up next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A New York appeals court overturned former movie producer Harvey Weinstein's 2020 rape conviction today. The court ruled that the trial judge should not have allowed women unrelated to the case to testify that Weinstein had assaulted them. Actress Ashley Judd, who is one of the first public figures to speak publicly about her experience with Weinstein, blasted the court's decision today.
Today is a day, like every day in American women's lives, when male sexual violence has intruded and disrupted our lives. This is what it's like to be a woman in America, living with male entitlement to our bodies.
The Manhattan DA says he will retry this case. Weinstein has been in prison serving a 23-year sentence. He was also convicted of a similar crime here in Los Angeles and sentenced to 16 years in prison. His lawyers plan to appeal that case on similar grounds. Joining me now is Maria Kramer. She's covering the story for The New York Times. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
This was a really split court decision, a 4-3 vote. Tell us what the court said.
So, yes, this was a very narrowly decided ruling. And essentially what the majority found was that the prosecution and the judge in the case, Justice James M. Burke, had essentially denied Harvey Weinstein his right to a fair trial by allowing two key strategies in place. One was using witnesses, women who had accused Mr. Weinstein of sexual assault, sexual abuse, but he had never been charged with that, allowing them to testify, and then also threatening to ask Mr. Weinstein about a series of other types of behavior that you could consider criminal or at the very least boorish if he were to take the stand in his own defense. And using both those strategies, they denied Mr. Weinstein a fair trial, according to the majority of the court.
Right. And so it was really this idea that could you rely on women who were not part of the case to establish a pattern? And that's something called the Molyneux, right, rule. And it is applicable in New York only. So
yes.
Talk a little bit about that and why that was such a hotly debated idea.
Right. So as you said, the Molyneux rule, it is unique to New York. And it's essentially a term that refers to witnesses in a trial who are allowed to testify about criminal acts that the defendant has not been charged with committing. This was always a risky venture by the prosecution because it can easily offer grounds for appeal for a defendant who's convicted when a prosecutor uses this strategy. But the prosecution felt like they had to go this route because, you know, essentially the case was resting on two witnesses, two women who had said that they were sexually assaulted by Harvey Weinstein, but who had also admitted that they had also had consensual sex with Mr. Weinstein, which, of course, reflects how difficult, how nuanced, how complex these types of sexual allegation charges can be, but also gives prosecutors a tougher time before a jury trying to convince them of a criminal act.
Okay, so Harvey Weinstein will not walk free today because he was also convicted here in Los Angeles, and he was sentenced to prison for 16 years, which he would serve after he finished his New York sentence. So presumably he will be sent to California to serve out that prison sentence. However, he also plans to appeal that on similar grounds. Can you talk about that?
Yes, so that's correct. It's unclear what's going to happen to Harvey Weinstein now. He is going to be taken out of state prison and most likely sent to Rikers Island while he waits for the current Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, to decide whether to retry the case. But yes, you're correct. He also still faces the sentence in California, and his attorney there is said she's very encouraged by the decision of the court in New York, because she feels like the same factors contributed to his conviction here, that the jury just heard these horrible, horrible things about this man and were so tainted by that evidence that they had no choice but to convict.
Although, as I understand it, there is a California law that specifically allows the testimony of former victims who are not part of the case.
Yes, but there was also a law that allowed that in New York, and we've seen how that goes. So you can see
Right.
why the defense in this case might be encouraged.
Right. And I understand also that he's represented by the same lawyer who represented Bill Cosby in his successful appeal, although on different grounds.
Correct, yes.
Okay, so we don't exactly know what's next, except that Harvey Weinstein is perhaps waiting for Alvin Bragg to decide whether or not he's going to pursue this. Alvin Bragg is a little busy these days, prosecuting Donald Trump. So how much longer do you think he will take to decide whether or not he'll retry this case?
It's very unclear at this point. I mean, as you said, Harvey Weinstein found out about this decision when he was, he's still serving his sentence in Mohawk Correctional Facility in upstate New York, most likely going to be transferred out of there. And he learned about it from someone at the prison who showed him a news report about the ruling. And at this point, all he can do is wait to see what Alvin Bragg will do. Alvin Bragg is a methodical district attorney, thinks very carefully about these things. He did not try this case. This was under his predecessor, Cy Vance Jr. So this is something that's now new before Mr. Bragg, and he's going to have to figure out what to do with it, and how long he takes, is as good a guess as I can make right now.
All right. Maria Kramer, New York Police Department Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Monday on Press Play, a new documentary looks at the musician Brian Eno, who is also a big producer. He helped craft the sounds of U2, David Bowie, Talking Heads, and many more. So we'll talk to the director of that new documentary on Brian Eno. Coming up next, how money and greed have taken over professional horse racing.
We don't see superstar horses anymore. We don't see horses that have really long careers, because as soon as they start to win, they're in the breeding shed.
A new documentary investigates why there have been so many accidents and horse deaths on racetracks. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Known as the sport of kings because of its origins in the British monarchy, horse racing now is in crisis. Last year, a dozen horses died while competing at the Kentucky Derby. But it's not just the Derby. The Preakness Stakes, the Belmont Stakes in New York, and Santa Anita Park here in Southern California all have seen horse deaths recently. There's a lot of money to be made in horse racing, and that has led to some criminal activity, including doping, which may be one factor in why all these horses are dying. All this is the focus of a new documentary from the New York Times and FX. It's called Broken Horses.
They are drugged and doped. It's simple animal exploitation, animal cruelty, and animal killing, and it has to end.
It's hard to explain dead racehorses, right?
We got to get rid of the bad actors in the sport, and we got to get rid of all these drugs.
Joining me now is Melissa Hoppert. She covers horse racing for The Times, and she's a producer on the film, and she's in the film. Welcome to Press Play, Melissa.
Thank you.
So the Kentucky Derby, this is the big one, the oldest sporting event in the United States. Horse racing does have a huge following. There's lots of glamour around it, and the horses are just beautiful and beautiful to watch. What is it, though, about this sport that captures the imagination of so many people?
I mean, I think it's the animals. It's so beautiful to watch them race in full flight and with a jockey on their back, and the way that they move and work together and come thundering down the stretch. It's so exhilarating. I mean, even to watch it on TV, but to be there in person, it's just a whole different experience. And, you know, there's such a history to horse racing. And when you go to the track, you feel that history, especially a place like Churchill Downs with the twin spires and the mint juleps and the hats. It's a really fun experience if you've never been before. And I think people are really drawn to that.
And a lot of money is drawn to that, too. Talk about that aspect of it. How has it become such a lucrative sport for so many people?
Yeah, I mean, there's money all around racing in many ways. You know, there's the gambling aspect, especially on the biggest races like the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness Stakes, the Belmont Stakes every year. There's the whole money aspect on that side of it, the horse playing and the gambling. And then there's also just the money that could be made on the track and then also in the breeding shed. And what's really happened in the past, you know, so many years is that horses have started to make more money in the breeding shed than they make on the racetrack. So we don't see superstar horses anymore. We don't see horses that have really long careers that people follow from track to track, because as soon as they start to win, they're in the breeding shed.
Making other horses that
yes.
are winners. Okay.
So you can see it's a cycle.
Right. And there's also the money and the buying and the selling of these horses. And so hence the rise of the super trainer, which you talk about in the movie. What is a super trainer?
A super trainer is, I mean, it really started with a trainer named D. Wayne Lucas, who's called the Coach. He was the first trainer to really popularize having huge stables at multiple racetracks at once. And, you know, so many people have followed in his footsteps, including Bob Baffert, who's based in California. You know, he's based at Santa Anita, but he races also at Del Mar in Southern California. But then he also races in California, New York, Florida, Dubai. He races all over the world. So, you know, there's a handful of these super trainers that get all of the best horses and have huge stables that are based, you know, internationally and all over the United States. And, you know, you just don't see the little guys at the Kentucky Derby that much anymore.
And Bob Baffert, just, he seems like a flamboyant figure. He's got that big head of white hair, and he just, you know, he seems like a larger than life character. His horses have won a record 6 Kentucky Derbies and hundreds of millions of dollars in earnings. He wasn't in your film, or he didn't talk to you for your film, but he's currently banned from the Kentucky Derby. One of his horses tested positive for a steroid after winning in 2021. So what is his reputation now?
Yeah, I mean, Bob Baffert is the most recognizable person in the sport. You know, people at the supermarket, you could say, who do you know from horse racing? They would say, oh, the guy with the white hair. But what happened in 2021 when his horse Medina Spirit won the Kentucky Derby and then subsequently came out that he had tested positive for betamethasone, which is basically a painkiller. You know, Churchill Downs acted really swiftly and banned him for 2 years once the split sample was confirmed. So he wasn't in the past 2 Kentucky Derbies. And then his first race back was this year's Preakness. And we kind of delve into that a lot in the film, because on the undercard of that day's race, a horse named Having a Meltdown that he trained actually suffered a catastrophic leg injury and broke down. And it was supposed to be like Bob's triumphant return. And then to have that, you know, happen on the undercard was just really devastating for him, but also just kind of, it kind of left a sour taste in people's mouths, I think. Like, you know, because he had just had the positive test and he was banned and it was his first big race back. So it's definitely been, you know, top of mind. A lot of people are still talking about Bob Baffert, even though he's not racing in the 150th Derby.
But he's not the only one who has given drugs or banned substances to their horses. And here's a clip from your movie where people are talking about how common it is.
This here is the blood doper, Epogen. It's what Lance Armstrong was using. It's very difficult to detect and can take a racehorse and make them compete beyond their normal physiological capacity.
Over the years, I've seen everything tried. Cancer medicines, diabetes medicines, cobra venom, frog venom, cayenne pepper on their genitals.
Cocaine, Viagra, you name it.
Wow. So how common is it for racehorses to be doped up?
So horses are being over-medicated, period. And that's with legal medications as well. So there's, you know, what's considered doping, which is like illegal banned substances. And then there's also controlled medications in which you can give all the way up into a certain time frame within a race in a certain amount. And, you know, for as long as horse racing has existed, people have tried to get an edge. Surely they have been giving drugs to these horses all along. But I think there really was a proliferation of these drugs when the money started to really explode. And so it's kind of just this cycle that, you know, it sort of rewards people who are winning. That's not to say that they aren't doing something about it. This year, actually, a group named HISA came in that's government regulated that is trying to clean up the sport. So there is a control now, like for this, there is a robust anti-doping program in place, but it's just getting started. And, you know, this really came after the clip, you know, the clip that you were playing was from the 2020 FBI investigation. You know, more than 20 people were charged in that ring. You know, that's when the government really came, said, we need to start regulating this and we need uniform drug rules. And because previous to HISA being formed, it was every jurisdiction is run state by state. So each state makes up its own rules. So you can go and race a horse in Kentucky and it's a different set of rules when you race a horse in New York.
HISA is the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Authority created in 2020. And is the thinking that the reason for all of these racehorse deaths in competition is because of the doping? Does it do something to make them fall more easily or in some way make their heart stop or whatever it is? I don't know. That's killing these horses. But is it tied to the doping?
It's multifactorial. There's not one smoking gun. It's a little bit of everything. And drugs certainly are playing a problem because what these drugs are doing is they're masking pain. So a lot of these horses will, you know, they're sore, they're tired, they're not given enough time in between races and between workouts to recover, and that bone doesn't recover. And then they go out and, you know, they had a pre-existing condition and they, you know, they could break a leg. But it's not the only factor. And I'm certainly not saying that any of these horses were doped because all of their drug tests came back clean at Saratoga, at the Derby. But that doesn't mean that they weren't given a ton of medication. They're, you know, pain pills, painkillers are, certain painkillers are legal in horse racing. You know, one common practice is to give horses injection in their fetlock joint to kill, you know, to numb the pain. And some of these horses were shown to have been given these interarticular injections before races.
Right. So when they're bred to run fast, I guess, does that make their legs or the bones like a little more fragile? Are their legs just not able to withstand as much hard and intense work as these horses are put through?
Yeah, I think a lot of experts would agree that the breed has become weaker because when you're breeding these horses with very sleek bodies, with these spindly legs that, you know, are super fast and can go out and win a short distance. But they're not built to, you know, race several years like the horses used to do. Like in the past year from the Derby, most of those horses are retired already. They get injured very easily. They just don't have the stamina anymore. They don't have the endurance. They're injured very easily. And a lot of theories is that there's just a lot of overbreeding within the population.
Okay, so there's the doping, there's the overbreeding, a lot of problems. And is there a move to clean up any/all of this? Because on the other side, there are people saying that horse racing should be banned entirely.
Yes, there is. You know, I would, HISA is tasked with cleaning up horse racing from the time they cover horses, from the time a horse gets on the racetrack and records their first official workout to the time that horse retires. And their purview is not just drugs. It's all safety initiatives. So they're looking at racetrack surfaces and improvements there. They're looking at, you know, they give tracks accreditations for safety. So they go through, you know, there's all of these boxes that they are checking and they are trying to make it safer. There's a long way to go. And also, I mean, part of what we explore in the film, though, is that that's great. They're regulating the horses when they're on the track. But what about horse sales? What about, you know, the breeding practices? And if you ask HISA about that, they say, well, that's not really our purview. When we were created, that doesn't fall under our jurisdiction. Mm. So while HISA is a great start, it's not everything that could be done.
You, Melissa, have been covering this sport for more than 17 years, and you are a huge fan, too. I can tell. What is it about horse racing that you love so much?
You know, my uncle married into a family that owned and bred horses, and that's sort of how I got hooked. I went to a race with them. They had one really, really good racehorse that raced at Keeneland, and, you know, went to the winner's circle, and I just thought this is the coolest thing. But just being around these animals, watching these people like take care of the horses, you know, I just want to make it clear that like not everybody's a bad person in horse racing. And you wouldn't do this job if you didn't love the animals. And it's just so neat to see. It's like you feel like you step back in time to like really go to these barns and see these animals and watch them train. And, you know, it's like the history. You have Secretariat and Seabiscuit, and, you know, it does have a glamorous side to it. And so I think that's what draws people to the races. It's what drew me to the races. But, you know, I've also been covering this long enough to see the bad side of things. And I think it's important to also tell those stories and also call that out, because, you know, it's not okay. Like covering the races this year was really hard to do. It was, you know, seeing some of these breakdowns in person, it's horrible.
Right, because you know that when a horse falls and breaks its leg, that's it. They have to put them down immediately, right?
Yeah, I mean, some horses can be saved. It depends on the injury, but 9 times out of 10, they have to be euthanized. It's a really long road to recovery. They're so heavy, and they're, you know, like we talked about, their spindly legs. Mm-hmm. To put all of that weight on 3 legs instead of 4, it's almost impossible, and they develop all kinds of problems after they've had that type of injury.
Oh, so sad. They are so magnificent, and I don't know, they've played such a key role in our history over the millennia. So
they did, and I think that's one really cool aspect about the sport. I mean, you could just, you know, the sport of kings, it was true, you know, like Del Mar, it was, you know, Hollywood's glamour set, you know, all like starting that racetrack and with Bing Crosby, and it's just, there is good things about the sport, but, you know, there's still a lot to do.
Melissa Hoppert, she covers horse racing for the New York Times, and she's a producer of the new documentary called Broken Horses, which premieres on FX on Friday. Melissa, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we will have your weekend movie reviews, including the new Zendaya movie set in the world of professional tennis. That's next on Press Play. This is 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand, and it's time for some film reviews. This week, we have a steamy tennis romp starring Zendaya in a post-Dune victory lap, a documentary about a New York photographer who captured the city's gritty 70s and 80s zeitgeist, a Japanese film about a secret gay romance, and a reissue of Ridley Scott's cult classic, Alien, on its 45th anniversary. Wow. Alonzo Duralde and Dave White are here to guide us through it all. They are film critics and co-hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. And Alonzo is the author of the forthcoming book, Hollywood Pride, which comes out next month. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello. Okay, first up, let's talk about Challengers. This is a film from the director of Call Me By Your Name. So, of course, it's got to be steamy. And it treats tennis as a metaphor for competition in a love triangle.
What are you going to do now?
Unfortunately, my only skill in life is hitting a ball with a racket.
I want you to be my coach. I want you to be my coach.
How often does this happen? Going after the same girl? Come here.
Which one of us?
Alonzo, is this Jules and Jim on the tennis court or off the tennis court? What's happening?
Kind of, sort of. You mentioned early on that it's a metaphor, and Zendaya's character says early on, tennis isn't a game, it's a relationship. And so you have these three people who first meet in 2006 when they are in the finals of the Junior U.S. Open, and how their relationships evolve over the next 13 years. The movie is kind of framed by this one tennis match that's happening in 2019. And we keep getting a series of flashbacks that show us how we got there and who these people are and who they are to each other and how they manipulate or play off of or control or are controlled by each other in a way that very much mirrors their tactics on the court. But this is a thrilling piece of filmmaking from the way that Guadagnino and his longtime cinematographer capture bodies in motion to Justin Kuritsky's thrilling screenplay, which in its use of flashback is constantly giving you just enough information, but then surprising you with something you didn't know that had been withheld until just the right moment. And all of this is balanced by three incredible lead performances by Zendaya, by Mike Feist, and Josh O'Connor. They really play off each other, if you'll pardon the expression, in a really beautiful way.
Ooh, okay. And Zendaya is just fabulous, I think, in anything that she's in, including perfume ads. So, Dave, what do you think?
I was right there for the full wildness of these lovers. And they are lovers, even as they are also very much intense rivals. The characters are what really drive this movie. They make grave judgment errors and selfish moves. They're complex. They're not always good. It often destabilizes who you think you might be rooting for. And mostly what I love is that these are the kinds of films that tend to wind up at the art house now. Movies that reflect people being people. So it's exciting to watch this get a big release treatment, and it deserves it. And of course, because it is a film from Luca Guadagnino, we're being given the full physicality of these relationships as well. Alonzo is fond of calling him a sensualist. But to get down to the real sort of nitty-gritty about it, this is a formally horny filmmaker who knows exactly how to simultaneously frame his subjects and capture their lusts, their longing, their motives. And the score is something very special as well. Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross are digging into this late 80s club culture, where Nine Inch Nails figured quite prominently, there need to be more films scored to pounding electro house, please.
Challengers in theaters tomorrow. Next up, we have Uncropped, a documentary featuring a New York City street photographer named James Hamilton.
Every one of these photographs has James in the photograph. That's why it's funny or poignant or noir.
There's always something else going on. It's not just the subject.
That shot could be a Cardi Bresson. The moment, the framing, friggin' blew my mind.
The best pictures, it's always some little thing that happens.
His portraits are so revealing. You would respond to this like somebody punched you in the chest.
Oh, okay, Dave. Honestly, I don't really know the name James Hamilton when it comes to famed New York City street photographers like, I don't know, Dion Arbus or Gary Winogrand Ouija or any of the other ones that come to mind. Even Annie Leibovitz. So, but he was as or more prolific. And just looking at the trailer, his photos are really astonishing. So tell us more about who he is.
Well, he, as I said, he's a photojournalist. He's been working in New York since the 1960s, and he has taken everyone's picture. He's photographed bands, actors, the fashion world, film sets, war zones, people on the street, everybody who crossed his path in life or just on assignment. But this story of his career is important because it intersects with the world of print journalism, magazines, newspapers, and most importantly, the world of the alternative weekly newspaper. So he, along with Sylvia Plackey, who's also interviewed here quite a bit, often side by side with him, helped make The Village Voice, a paper that just looked as cool as it read. This is a really wonderful documentary, and it's a retrieval of recent history that's changing very quickly. It's inspiring to watch people who decided that they had no choice but to make their lives out of their creative impulses. And it's also, as captured here in the film, disheartening to watch how corporate meddlers have gone in and scooped up publications and then killed them.
Oh, wow. I know. I was in New York in the Village Voice days, and I remember just it was a must read and a must look at with the photographs. So, Alonzo, New York City seems to be the other subject in this movie.
I mean, yes, in a way, because this is a guy who's covering everything from, you know, sort of fancy society parties to, you know, rock stars who are at the Chelsea Hotel. But the thing about Hamilton that's so fascinating is that he's also like one of the first photographers to get images out of the Tiananmen Square massacre. He's also somebody who went and spent months in Ethiopia covering the war there. So he, you know, can mix in this world of glamour and do, you know, the set photographs for the Royal Tenenbaums. But he, you know, contains multitudes, and his camera as unflinchingly captures, you know, child soldiers and massacres as it does, you know, the bright and the beautiful.
Uncropped is showing at the Lemley Royal beginning tomorrow, and in a couple of weeks it'll be on video on demand. Our next film, Egoist, portrays a romance between a Tokyo magazine editor and a personal trainer with a secret life. Okay, so there's a scene between the two main characters where they are meeting one of the characters' parents. And Dave, what did you think of this film? Tell us more about the plot.
So it's about a successful gay fashion magazine editor in Tokyo named Hosuki, played by the actor Ryohei Suzuki. He has a very cool job and a solid team of fellow gay friends. And he meets a somewhat younger personal trainer named Ryuta, played by Hio Miyazawa, and they fall in love. But soon after that, the younger man explains that he is a sex worker in order to help take care of his aging mother. And he says this in order to tell Hosuki that he cannot be in this relationship. It would just complicate it too much. And Hosuki, in turn, offers to pay his way so that he can quit that line of work. Now, from that premise and the title, you might think you're about to get something a little more dangerous than you get, but there is a midpoint twist that flips the title and the premise upside down, and the story becomes something very quiet, and it becomes a narrative of caretaking and love that offers Hosuki a way to retrieve something that he lost even earlier in life. And it's about trading in one idea about your life in favor of another. And it's pretty sentimental, but it doesn't overdo it. And I found it very moving.
Okay. Alonzo, what does this do in terms of portraying a gay love story? Does it capture it in a moving, accurate way?
Yeah, certainly. And I think, you know, obviously all queer love stories are very much about the context of where they're made and when they're made. And so, you know, I'm not an expert in queer life in contemporary Japan, but it is not identical to queer life in contemporary America. And so even in a city as cosmopolitan as Tokyo, you have these men who are, you know, as you say, they go to meet the parents and it's all like, oh, I haven't met the right woman yet. We're right. Just really close friends. But yeah, the film goes to places that are very moving and very powerful. And yeah, there is sentimentality here. There are, you know, hints of melodrama, but I'm always reminded of Pauline Kael had a review of the great Betty Davis movie, Now Voyager, which is a great sort of sumptuous old Hollywood kind of tearjerker. And Kael said that if the movie were any better, it wouldn't be any good at all. And so sometimes movies have to lean into the heavy emotionality, even if that is a thing that you know, cool film critics might disdain. And this movie owns what it is.
Egoist is out now in limited release. Finally, a 45th anniversary re-release of Alien. That's from the original trailer. No dialogue in that trailer, just a bunch of quick cuts. It's really incredible. And then the line at the end, of course, the classic line, speaking of classic lines, in space, no one can hear you scream. 1979, Alonzo, 2 years after the first Star Wars came out. And at the time, it received mixed reviews. So how does it hold up today, do you think?
Oh, I think it's an unquestioned classic now. I mean, 3 years later, Ridley Scott would also make the critically mixed Blade Runner. And obviously that movie has aged well as well. Yeah, so it's exciting to see Alien back on the big screen, not just because it's Alien and it is one of the great horror movies of all time, but also because I think we're seeing studios more and more going back into the habit of reissuing films, which, you know, in the days, in ye olden times before cable and VHS, it was not uncommon for every few years a studio to re-release a beloved film. You know, the Disney animated films were always in kind of a 7-year cycle. And they would do new trailers and a new poster, and it was a big thing. And that's what Disney is doing for Alien. And I hope we're seeing more of it. I think it's a win-win. The studios own these movies. They don't have to make them again. And audiences are hungry to see films that they love on the big screen. And theaters could certainly use the traffic of the people who want to see those movies on the big screen. So more of this, please, studios.
Definitely. And Dave, how does this original compare, do you think, to the sequels?
Oh, well, see, the first time I saw this movie was the opening weekend in 1979. My mom took me to see it because I was still too young to get into R-rated movies alone. And I have physical memories of the freak out to this day. It is not.
Wait, is that child abuse?
No, that's good parenting. It's not a jolting jump scare film. It's such a slowly and steadily encroaching experience of dread and fear. You don't realize at first what's happening and how the details are being laid out and how its atmosphere is taking over and becoming overwhelming. So I have parenting tips. Be a good parent and shock your children with this one, and they will thank you for it later, especially if they don't know anything about it. Most importantly, getting back to what Alonzo said about the re-release world that used to be, this is how, as a child, I got to see films that were older than me. You know, they would just come back. And the theatrical experience here for this particular film, this like all-timer classic horror movie, is what really matters. It will overwhelm you on the big screen if you've never seen it before. If you have seen it before, this 4K is going to allow you to get even deeper into the gloomy set and shadows of this industrial looking spaceship. It is a very powerful experience on the big screen because you cannot escape to the kitchen or your phone. I'm all in favor of this getting a re-release. I'm in favor of every one of these old movies getting re-releases. Bring them all back.
Alien returns to theaters. It's in wide release, but for a limited time beginning tomorrow. And that does it for this week. The OGs, Alonzo Duraldi and Dave White, film critics and co-hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Brian Hartzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, Nihar Patel, Jack Ross, and Zeke Reed. Ted Robbins was our line editor this week. Amy Ta is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Our technical director is Super Mario Saavedra, with engineering help this week from Mike Stark. So come back right here tomorrow for KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. Democrats worried that RFK Jr.'s presidential run could take votes from President Joe Biden, but new polls say that may not necessarily be the case. So check it out, Left, Right, and Center, tomorrow at noon and 7 here on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening today, and I'll see you here again on Monday.